History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, by now, we ought to know they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. We've had the privilege of meeting veterans all over the country, and it's always encouraging to see how different communities honor those who have served. Hillsdale, Michigan is one of those places where the patriotism is palpable and where veterans have long been venerated. The voice you're going to hear today is one football fans there have been listening to for almost a quarter century. But that might never have happened if the shrapnel that produced his Purple Heart almost 60 years ago would have been placed a few inches away. Marine Corps veteran Dan Beischer is our guest today in an interview recorded in the impressive new studios of our affiliate station WRFH, which has been airing Hometown Heroes twice a weekend for the better part of a decade.
It does strike me that we're sitting here in the studio of Radio Free Hillsdale in a building that was built in the 1930s as a WPA project and was an elementary school, and you've actually been in this building before.
Yes, I have. I started kindergarten here. I remember my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Betts, Anna Betts. I sure do.
You remember what life was like back then growing up in this community?
It was different than it is today. The college was much smaller. They might have had 400 or 500 students back then. The biggest thing when the college was the football team. They had a 34-game winning streak, and the community was kind of behind them in those days. It was a small town. In the late 40s and early 50s, Hillsdale was a pretty small town. Today, it's a small city. And growing. Even despite losing a lot of manufacturing jobs, Hillsdale has somehow managed to survive and grow.
And you've seen all that, and you've seen a lot of football over the years. What's your first Hillsdale Charger football memory?
That would have been in 1952 when I became friends with the president's son, Mack Wayne Phillips. We were in the second grade here at Mock School, and he invited me to a football game. We come from not a whole lot. And to knock on the door of the president's home, and they call Broadlawn, and have the maid open the door was a huge shock. I learned what a line of scrimmage was that day and got to see my first game. It had been in the fall of 1952.
Did you fall in love at first sight?
No, I probably didn't. You know, I was pretty young and had a lot of different interests as a youngster.
Yeah, what were some of those ambitions? Because you're growing up in the wake of World War II, and it was a different world in a lot of ways.
Yes.
In those years. What do you remember about that childhood and maybe some of the hopes and dreams that you had?
Well, considering the fact that my family's been in Hillsdale County, part of my family, since 1830. They were some of the original pioneers on my mother's side. And on my father's side, they had been pioneers down in Henry and Hancock counties in northwestern Ohio. It was a different place, no doubt about it. But my childhood kind of mimics J.D. Vance. J.D. and I have a lot in common in that respect. It wasn't my first 14 years of my life were tough. The things I remember the most was just trying to stay by my mom and help her out. And then I had a little brother and a little sister. I'm the oldest. So helping my mom out with them and trying to grow. And I remember I was probably in the seventh grade when I had this idea, maybe someday I'll be a writer. I didn't know really what that was all about, but for some reason I like to read. So that came across my mind. I thought that would be impossible, but as it happened, it came to pass.
I'm sure you're learning in school about World War II. You're alive, you're a young boy when the Korean War is going on.
Yes.
Had you ever considered a future in the military?
Yeah. In fact, back in those days for young kids, playing Army was a big deal. You know, either cowboys and Indians or playing Army. So I had given that some thought. In fact, well, I was in the Boy Scouts, and I graduated from Boy Scouts to Sea Scouts, which is part of the Explorer program back in the day. So I had a naval uniform, the whole 9 yards with the little hat and his pea coat, and I liked it. I liked the structure, the activities, and so that, you know, kind of planted a seed in my mind. So later, after I graduated from high school, I was working in a local Ford dealership, and I quit my job so I could have fun all summer and figure out what I wanted to do when fall came around, when all my friends went back to school or went in the military or off to college or whatever. I walked down to the City Hall here in Hillsdale with the idea of enlisting either in the Air Force or the Navy. Both those recruiters happened to be across the street having lunch, and the Marine recruiter invited me into his office, and make a long story short, I signed my name and enlisted in the Marine Corps, and it was probably the best decision certainly at that time, the best decision I had ever made.
Even though it almost cost you your life.
Well, yes. However, I didn't know what I was going to do in the Marines, whether I was going to be a rifleman or a tanker or a communications. I had no idea until after boot leave, I reported in to Camp Pendleton, and it was the base newspaper and public affairs office. And so I became a press information man. Then when I went to Vietnam, I got my orders to Vietnam. I had that title of combat correspondent, and I learned how to write. A lot of it just on-the-job training. And I had a lot of stories published in Stars and Stripes and military post and station papers, and that launched me into a career. And I made up my mind while I was in Vietnam, well, I need to go to college. And so once my tour was over, I did that and got accepted into college and was able to go to college. But Vietnam was obviously, I've studied it for years and years. I have quite an extensive library. And while I was in the Marine Corps, I had met a lot of fellows that were in Korean War veterans, and a few of them were World War II veterans. And I learned things from them about life and about what it had been like for them and their period of service. And some of it wasn't very pleasant. And that was true of Vietnam, too. We did our thing in Vietnam. We were ordered to go there, and we went. We did our duty, and unfortunately, more than 58,000 of us didn't make it back. Then hundreds of thousands or more have committed suicide. So kind of a rough deal all in all, but we just didn't have the support of the people back home, except our immediate families. And even some guys, even their immediate families didn't support them, and that was really hard. Yeah, it was a different deal, that's for certain.
And I've got some questions about that. And you mentioned the 58,000 names that are on the wall, and you mentioned the suicides. And then there's the whole Agent Orange phenomenon, too, that has curtailed so many lives. But let's go back before you knew any of that. October 1963, you enlist in the Marine Corps. Did you know what a Marine really was? Were you in for any kind of awakening there?
Oh, boy. Yeah, the first night when you get off the bus at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, and this huge, ugly person screaming at you and telling you to get your effing feet on the yellow footprints, that was really scary, actually. I mean, we were all pretty scared for about the first 2 or 3 weeks, and then we started to get into the flow of what was happening and what they were doing to train us. Although we could probably have used a little bit more training, all in all, it served its purpose. And for that, I was glad. I remember I was in Platoon 379, 3rd Battalion, and my drill instructors were Staff Sergeant Washington and Sergeant Fleck, and Sergeant Larry Grubbs. After all these years, I remember their names. And two of them, Flick and Washington, were Korean War veterans. And Grubbs later served in Vietnam. And I believe he won a Silver Star, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, and that's the other thing that came to mind. So October 1963, are you aware at all of what's been building up in Southeast Asia and that there's any possibility of you getting deployed over there?
No, it's just vaguely. Mm-hmm. I think in 64, when Life magazine, one of the best photographers and writers was a guy named Larry Burroughs, who was quite well known, and I actually escorted him on combat missions later in Vietnam. But there was a big series of stories in Life magazine about what was happening in Vietnam and these unbelievable photographs. And I think most of us were sort of aware there was something serious was going on. Then throughout the year 1964 up into 1965, we knew something was big was happening, especially in March of 65 at Camp Pendleton when the 7th Marine Regiment and the 5th Marine Regiment, they were mobilized and sent to Vietnam. A couple of my friends that I had served with went that early in March. I didn't get my orders until August, actually a late July, and then I actually went over in August of 1965.
And, you know, we hear a lot of stories, and you've told a lot of stories, but we don't always hear about the journalists, the war correspondents. If we pay attention enough, we know that can be just as dangerous as being in a rifle platoon or artillery or anything. Probably the most famous war correspondent of all time, right? Ernie Pyle, killed
Ernie
in
Pyle,
World War
yes.
II toward the end. So how did you feel about this idea, going over to Vietnam, embedded with the troops?
Well, at first, I wasn't sure what my job was going to be, because while I was at Camp Pendleton and working in the base newspaper, we had so many young guys coming in that they sent some of us out for a six-month temporary additional duty to either the riding stables or the swimming pool. I chose the golf course, learned how to play golf. I always wanted to learn how to play golf. So I worked on the driving range at Camp Pendleton Golf Course. And when that was done, and I did another couple of months as a clerk in the headquarters battalion. I wasn't really sure when they sent me to Vietnam what my job was going to be. But when I got there and they assigned me, it was to the Informational Services Office. We used to call it ISO, but I was very happy that I had got to serve my previous MOS. But even at that time, I wasn't sure what I was going to be doing. And I'd been there about a week when I went out on an operation, and it was kind of gruesome what happened. And so I all of a sudden I knew that, hey, I'm a war correspondent, you know, a military war correspondent, and this is not all going to be fun.
Well, and I just got done speaking to some journalism students here at Hillsdale, and I told them the best material is always the result of a follow-up question. So when the person you're interviewing says something and they act like it's not that big a deal or they don't go too deep in it, make sure you follow up. And so you just told me that this operation was pretty gruesome. And I don't want to be salacious. Obviously, don't want you to share anything you're not comfortable, but it's clear this made an impression on a young Marine.
Yeah, it did. I was sitting in our hardback tent, which was just a wooden frame with a tent over the top for a roof. And our section chief said, Lance Corporal Beischer, he says, grab your rifle and go down to the helipad with so-and-so here and a couple of other correspondents. And I had no idea what we were doing. And so I did. It was my first helicopter ride. I'd never ridden on a helicopter. They took us out to a place called Hill 55. We landed, and there was just a brief firefight. And I wasn't even concerned because, I had Marines all around me. But later that night, we had to stay for the night. We didn't just fly out there and fly back. I didn't take enough gear. I didn't know what I was doing at that time. So I was sleeping on the ground, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a huge explosion. And what had happened is the battalion commander, a lieutenant colonel, and his radio man were blown into bits and pieces. They tripped a 155 millimeter artillery round that had been booby trapped by the Viet Cong. To hear that and then see the results of it the next morning, boy, that was a shock, and I realized, oh boy, this is that could happen to me. So I started to be a little bit more, I guess you'd say, I was trying to be more careful with what I was doing and not be so nonchalant, and I realized, hey, this is for real. I could lose my life. And at the time, I was married. I was young. I was only 20 years old. I was married, and I had my wife was pregnant. I didn't see my son until he was 10 months old when I came home. So all that was in my mind, you know, that I could die, and that would leave my wife with a baby and no husband.
Yeah, boy, and you described that really well. That puts us in your shoes. But, I mean, it sounds like you're saying any naivete, or I don't know if innocence is the right word, but there were some things taken from you in that moment that you couldn't pretend this wasn't life and death.
You're exactly correct, Paul. I did lose some innocence over there, no doubt about it. And even today, I mean, I'm constantly reminded of it. The Veterans Administration has me listed as 100% disabled. I have Agent Orange. I have all the symptoms of Agent Orange. Even though I was there pretty early in the war, in 1965 and 66, they were using those kinds of chemicals, and we were exposed to some of it. So, but I lost a lot of innocence in Vietnam, and I did not realize what all that kind of environment and that kind of trauma does to the mind of a young man. And when I came back, I wasn't the best husband, and I wasn't the best person. And I'd had a lot of success in the Marine Corps. I made Sergeant E5 before I got out. I had a Purple Heart and a lot of ribbons and was given a lot of responsibility. And then I got accepted to college, and nobody in my family had ever been to college. In college, I had a lot of success and being elected to the student government and being president of this and chairman of that. And a lot of that went to my head. I hadn't had those things as a child. I wasn't anything in high school. I mean, I was kind of popular, but I didn't involve any clubs or sports. And there was a lot of reasons why that happened. But unfortunately, when I came home, like I say, I hadn't really realized how that whole experience had affected me physically and mentally.
I know quite a few veterans listening right now can relate to that. It is time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear how Dan Beischer earned the Purple Heart with the 3rd Marine Division in Vietnam. You can find photos of Dan then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with a Purple Heart Marine named Dan Beischer, recorded in the studios of affiliate WRFH on the campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where Hometown Heroes airs every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and every Sunday night at 9 p.m. Dan's 4 years of active duty Marine Corps service included 13 months in Vietnam with the 3rd Marine Division as a journalist, with his articles appearing in Stars and Stripes and other military publications.
So you're married, 20-year-old Marine in Vietnam, married. How often did you correspond with your wife?
Well, I wrote a lot of letters, and she wrote me often, too. At first, I was in Da Nang for about, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks, and then they sent me down to Chu Lai, and I spent several months at Chu Lai. I was there during Christmas and New Year's of 65, 66. I often got letters just about every week from my wife. And I wrote letters as often as I could. But back then, of course, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have all the email and all that sort of thing. And it was just like World War II. You know, mail call was a big deal.
And how much did you actually share with her about what was going on and what you were seeing, what you were experiencing?
Some, but I stopped. I kind of figured, that might not be a good idea to... Because number one, nobody's going to understand it. I mean, you can't possibly explain combat unless you've experienced it. I mean, nobody's going to understand. It's just impossible. And I've learned that, too, from Korean and World War II veterans and told me the same thing. You've been in combat. When you go into combat, nobody's going to understand, so don't try to talk about it.
Mm. And that can be a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
It can protect you and hurt you at the same time.
Right.
So you're over there. Your job is to tell the story of this war, to capture some of what's happening in print. But you're just as susceptible to a rocket attack, enemy artillery, a booby trap. What are some of the hazards, the threats to your life that you started to witness and identify?
I remember one time we had an operation, Double Eagle was the name of the operation, and we went aboard this transport ships and actually went over the on the big rope things down into the little mike boats and going to shore, and we thought we were going to, you know, land on the beach and be under fire, just like World War II. But when the ramps lowered on the little boats, there was NBC, CBS on the shore filming us. And we were stuck on that sandy beach for a couple of days. Then we started to move inland. And as we started to move inland, I remember one of the older non-commissioned officers saying, you know, pay attention to what's going on here. There might be snipers. And suddenly I heard this sound go by my ear. It sounded like a bunch of bees. And it was so close, I could actually feel it. And I said, oh, my God, I think I probably ran the fastest 100-yard dash that I'd ever ran in my life just to try to get out of there. And that was pretty scary. And then when I jumped out of a helicopter later on, somebody from, I don't know if it was NVA or VC, but they fired at us and hit the landing strut of the helicopter, and part of that round fragmented and hit me in the leg and knocked me down. And the worst part of being knocked down was, and once again, it was a wet rice paddy. I hated rice paddies landing there because you're going to get wet, and then you're going to be wet. Your feet are going to be wet for most of the day. And I was mad. I mean, I instead of being scared, I was actually mad that, and I remember, I could see the guy. He was on this hill, maybe 200 yards away. Well, being a Marine, I figured I'd blow him away, but I did shoot at him. I missed. And I'm kind of glad to this day, did I kill anybody? And, you know, sometimes people ask you that question, and I say, God, I hope not. You know, I don't want to even think about that. But, you know, I was a little bit of blood, and the corpsman came over and patched me up and sent me back to the rear. And I said, well, I don't want to go back to the rear. And he said, well, if they hang that tag on you that you've got a wound, you have to go. And that automatically means a Purple Heart. Well, of course, you know, big deal. That is a big deal, and especially today in the VA, if you've got a Purple Heart, all your medical is free. So I guess that worked out.
I've talked to a lot of guys who were wounded and haven't gotten the Purple Heart, right? If there wasn't someone there to document it. So it sounds like you weren't focused on the pain or the blood or the injury so much as your inconvenience?
Yes.
Because you couldn't do your job?
Inconvenienced, yeah. That was, it didn't, no, it really, I don't know why, but it didn't hurt that much. For some reason, it didn't hurt. And I knew guys that got awards like Bronze Stars with a V for Valor, and there were several of us that had done the same thing. We didn't get Bronze Stars for it. I mean, you know, no big deal.
Yeah, timing is everything, and who's there to witness it? And you witnessed a lot. You wrote about a lot. Can you give us a taste of some of the stories that you were telling as a journalist?
Sure. One of the units that I accompanied into the field quite a few times was the 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. Magnificent bastards, second to none. And at the time, the battalion commander was named Paul Kelly, P.X. Kelly, who later became the commandant of the Marine Corps. Yeah, I wrote about his unit quite often. One of the things I like to write about was the corpsmen and the work that they did outside of combat in the villages and how they helped with medical situations with the kids especially. And then other times, one time I wrote a story, we were out in the middle of the jungle or somewhere, and we saw something go across the sky, and somebody said, well, it's a UFO. And somebody else said, no, that's a Gemini, whatever, 5, 6, or 7. And then the Marines were talking, say, oh, man, I bet at least their feet are dry. And somebody else said, yeah, they probably got better chow than we do. And then somebody said, yeah, well, it looks dangerous up there. I thought, yeah. And so I wrote about that, and that got pretty good play in most of the military's And somebody actually told me that that little bit had made the New York Times, but I never did find it in the New York Times. So I think that was probably somebody trying to inflate my ego.
Never know. Maybe it'll turn up one of these days. Yeah. As an old New York Times clipping. And as you are telling these stories, you're getting the big picture. You know, you're talking about battles. It's part of the greater context of this war. But you're also seeing the human cost. When you think back on that time in Vietnam, are there some examples that come to mind to you of epitomizing courage or what those Marines represented to you?
Yeah. There was one time, it was just before Christmas, I had been in this landing zone, and I was in this medical tent, and I walked around in back of it, and there were 13 dead Marines. I remember one of them was a second lieutenant, and his watch was still running, and in his hands he was grasping rice paddy chutes. And I thought, how did he die, you know, and right before Christmas, and what would his family feel? So as you can tell, that still gets to me today. And then there was an operation that I was on with Colonel Kelly, Operation Texas, which I actually later, just a couple of years ago, I wrote an article for Leatherneck Magazine, remembering Operation Texas. We had a lot of casualties on that operation. In fact, I saw a helicopter being blown out of the sky, and we knew everybody on that thing was going to, you know, not make it. That was a hard thing to see, is seeing, you know, carrying Marines, dead Marines and wounded Marines to helicopters to get them out of there. That was tough. And makes you realize that it's absurd. We used to work in writer photo teams. And I was out, we were in this operation up in the jungle somewhere late at night. We were told to dig in. And so we were trying to dig some foxholes, and you could only get about maybe a foot down because it was so rocky and roots. And this photographer friend of mine, Ken Henderson, Corporal Henderson. We were just getting ready to eat some sea rations, and a firefight started, and we got down in our hole. We could hear the rounds going over our head, and all of a sudden, we started laughing. And I said, "What are we laughing about, Ken?" He says, "Damn," he says, "this is absurd." And he's right. The absurdity of killing each other for what? You know, and trying to understand, well, we're doing it for our country. We're doing our duty. And, you know, but was that true? We didn't. If you're 20, 21 years old, and, you know, you don't have the perspective that a lot of the World War II soldiers, you know, they knew what they were fighting for. But in Vietnam, we didn't always know what we were fighting for. We did at first. We thought we were doing all, but then later on, you know, you're wondering why. But we did our duty. We were Marines. And Marines are a little different breed. I know that even today, I've heard some of the young men that have been in the Desert Wars, and they said, you know, those people did not like to meet us. He says, they don't mind meeting maybe some of the Army units, but they didn't like meeting us because we didn't stop. We didn't quit for whatever reasons. And that's not to say anything bad about the Army. All those guys did their duty. That was the thing about Vietnam. And then you come home, and it wasn't like coming home from World War II, that's for sure.
And I want to talk about that, but I'm curious, too. You're over there in Vietnam. You're experiencing things like what you've shared with us. You're seeing things that nobody wants to see, no one should have to see. You're taking stock of some of the implications of that for the families of these Marines. And you've got a family. You've got a wife back home.
Yes.
Do you remember when you found out your son had been born, where you were, and how that news came to you?
November 2nd, 1965, I was in Chu Lai, and I got a telegram. That's how they used to let you know back in those days. I got a telegram saying that I had a bouncing baby boy. So that was really strange, being so young. And I didn't see him until 10 months later, in September, I think, of 66, when I came home. And here was this little person running around that kind of looked like me. And that was a shock. All of a sudden, you know, one week I'm in the jungles, and the next week I'm sitting in our living room with a little boy running around. And wow, that was hard to handle.
Well, and I'm just wondering, too, psychologically, once you got that news, did that affect your perspective on the rest of your time in Vietnam, or how you went about things, or your motivation to come home?
Yeah, but I knew that I had the job to do, and it wasn't going to change. I was going to go out with infantry units, and I knew we probably, sometimes you didn't see anything, nothing happened. They were just big, long, boring walkabouts. But other times, it would just happen all of a sudden. And we'd be ambushed, or some sniper would take a pot shot at us, and things would start to happen. And we too, had to escort a lot of civilian correspondents into the combat areas. And that was an experience too, because I was working with some real pros, well-known people in the field of journalism. A lot of them were making a name for themselves while they were there. And I can think of a whole bunch of names right off the top of my head, but I don't want to name drop, so.
Feel free. It might bring back some memories for people.
Well, Peter
listening.
Arnett, definitely. Larry Burroughs. Tim Page, he was an Englishman. He was about 6'5", I think. Later on, he was seriously wounded, and he actually wrote a book that I have a copy of somewhere. He lives in Australia, and I sent him the book to autograph, and he sent it back to me with a nice note. Then there was a French girl named Catherine Leroy, and then Dickie Chappelle. Dickie Chappelle was a well-known correspondent who had been on Iwo Jima with the Marines. Mm. She had been jailed by Castro and was part of the Hungarian Revolution. She covered that. And here she was in Vietnam. She died. I wasn't with her when this happened, but a good friend of mine was. He lives out near Seattle, Washington these days. But a Marine in front of her had tripped a booby trap, and it hit her in the neck and killed her. And Dickie Chappelle was well known back in those days. And if you Google her name, there's tons of information about Dickie Chappelle.
You know, for you, as each day is passing, are you starting to think of, hey, I'm going to get to go home, I'm going to see my wife, I'm going to meet this baby boy?
Every day. Every day that was on your mind. I remember one time when we were up at Fubai, a couple of interesting things happened, and I'll try to share these stories quickly. One of them was one day the section chief says, Corporal Beischer, he says, get over to the landing strip. There's this foreign general. He wants to go out to the rock pile. The rock pile was a place near the DMZ where we had Marines around the base, and on top we had observation recon Marines. And I said, well, who is he? He says, I don't know. He's just some foreign general. I said, well, how do I recognize him? He says, well, he's got a patch over his eye. Okay, so I go over to the airstrip, and I find this guy sitting on a bunch of gear when he's got a patch on his eye. And I walked up, introduced myself, and said, sir, I understand you want to go out to the rock pile. And yeah. So I commandeered a helicopter, and they were going there anyway for a resupply run. And we went aboard and landed, and I took this foreign general and introduced him to the battalion commander, whom I knew. Lieutenant Colonel said, well, Beischer, he said, why don't you go dig a hole for you and the general? He says he's going to spend the night and get him something to eat. So I dug the holes, and he came back about a half an hour later, and I offered him a can of Campbell's pork and beans that my wife had sent me. He declined. So I offered him some ham and lima beans, and he didn't like that either. So I said, later on, the colonel asked me, so would you feed the general, Beischer? And I says, he wasn't hungry. And he says, what'd you offer him? And I told him, he says, Beischer, Jews don't like pork. It was a Moshe Dayan. Of all people, I offered pork and beans to the future prime minister of Israel. That was weird. And another time I had to escort Frank Sutton, who played Sergeant Carter on Gomer Pyle. He wanted to go out and visit one of our CAC units, which was a platoon that would go out and live in a village to help provide security for that village. On the way back, it was getting a little late. I kept telling him, we got to go, we got to go. And finally, just as it was starting to get dark, and we were driving north on Highway 1, and I could see green tracers going across the road. I said, oh, no. And so I stopped, and then the red tracers from our was going. This is about half a mile up the road, and he was just absolutely scared out of his mind. And he says, what's happening? I said, well, the green ones, I says, that belongs to them, and the red ones belong to us. I says, don't worry. He says, it'll... I was driving this little mighty mite, and that all worked out. The platoon that had been ambushed took care of the situation, and we made it back to base with no problem. but Frank Sutton to Sergeant Carter, of all people.
Yeah, I wonder if he approached that role any differently after that experience.
I wondered that too. Good question.
Frank Sutton of Sergeant Carter fame had some firsthand combat experience to color his perspective, too. In fact, he and Dan Beischer have a lot in common. Not only have they both been radio announcers, Frank Sutton did that in his native Clarksville, Tennessee before World War II, they were also both awarded the Purple Heart. Sutton volunteered for the Marines during World War II, but was turned down because he was colorblind. The future Sergeant Carter ended up in the Army and took part in multiple assault landings in the Pacific with the 293rd Joint Assault Signal Company. It is time for our final break, but we're going to hear the rest of Dan Beischer's story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5555. 383328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with once a Marine, always a Marine, Dan Beischer, recorded in his hometown of Hillsdale, Michigan, where this weekend Dan will begin his 24th season as color analyst on Hillsdale College Charger football broadcasts. Thanks again to Scott Bertram and affiliate WRFH for allowing us to record in their sterling new studios. We've heard about how Dan earned the Purple Heart in Vietnam. He can also wear the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, the Naval Unit Citation, and Presidential Unit Citation, among other decorations.
As you got to the toward the end of your time there in country and knew you were going to have a chance to come home, did you feel any more pressure or apprehension about the danger in the situation, about making it to that end date of your deployment?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You didn't want to be wasted on your last day in Vietnam. And of course, that happened. A lot of people died on the first day and the last day. So, no, that was on your mind constantly, especially as you got what we call short timing, a little less time to go in Vietnam. And sometimes you didn't know exactly what day you were going to leave until they said, okay, get down to the airstrip, you're out of here. So, yeah, it was always on my mind.
And you alluded earlier to what you came home to and how the country felt about things then, or certain vocal elements in the country. So tell me about coming home.
Well, the first thing, we landed after a long flight from daylight through the night to daylight to night again. We landed at El Toro Marine Corps Base, and it was late at night. I had to get a taxi to take me to a place where I was going to meet my wife when she got out of work. So I got into the taxi, and I said, yeah, I just got back from Vietnam. And he says, so what? Well, that ended the conversation, and he didn't get a tip either. And I thought, well, that wasn't very cool, you know. I said, thanks a lot, dude. And for family, they didn't know. They, you know, it was just like, okay, let's go back to everything's normal again. And that was hard to handle. I didn't But I had a year left to go in the Marine Corps. And so after 3 weeks leave, which we made a trip back to Michigan to visit my family and then back to California, and I had to report into the Marine Corps Supply Center in Barstow, way out in the desert. Mm-hmm. Strange enough, this other Marine and myself were the first two to report into Barstow that had been to Vietnam. So we had all the ribbons, and he had a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, and I had a Purple Heart. Well, walking around base, you know, and all these people that had not yet been over there, we kind of stood out. We were sort of base heroes for a short while. Actually, that helped us a little bit because we were accepted among our own people, whereas in our civilian life, nobody cared. And then when I began college, I was actually asked to join the veterans fraternity, Chi Gamma Iota, XGI. I started off at Cerritos Community College and then matriculated to Cal State Fullerton. And that helped me a little bit, too, because the guys that I was in the club with, and we had activities and visited the Veterans Hospital and in Long Beach and trying to find a way to assimilate back into regular life, I guess you would call it. And for me, it was tough. I did not realize this, Paul, until years later, just how hard it had been for me. And I lost friends and some family because of how I was. Years later that I began to understand exactly what had happened and why.
Well, I definitely have a question about that, but I don't want to forget to ask you one I'm sure a lot of people have been curious about since they heard your wife was pregnant when you went over and that you didn't meet your son till he was 10 months old. That first time you laid eyes on him, you remember what that was like, how that felt?
It was like an electric shock. I mean, like I said before, this little guy, he was only 10 months old when he was walking and talking at that young age. Wow, it was a shock. I that's the best way that I can describe it. It took me a while to get used to that, especially when he started calling me daddy. Wow, that blew me away. I was not really mature enough to be a father at that age, to be honest. Today, actually, he moved from California. He's a certified public accountant and the principal of his own accounting firm here in Hillsdale. So, yeah, a real shock. I can't describe it in any other way than, oh my golly, that's part of me.
And when you talked about being wounded physically, the reason you have the Purple Heart, when you got hit by shrapnel in your leg, you kind of downplayed that a little bit. And as I hear you describe what it was like when you came back, am I inferring correctly that from your experience, the mental, emotional, psychological wounds have been a greater challenge than the physical wounds?
Yeah, by far. Yeah. My wife, my first wife, died in a car accident. Mm. I've been widowed once and divorced twice, and I'm married now to a wonderful woman. Finally, I met the right woman. We've been married for 15 years, and for the last almost 30 years now, I've lived on our family centennial, Michigan Centennial Farm. It's been my family since 1872. Mm. And about 5 years ago, I built a new home on a hill overlooking our fields and our woods. And I finally, which makes me a little emotional.
Is there something that made the biggest difference in getting to that point, in experiencing that peace?
I think the combination of going to the veterans, you know, going to the VA. I go to the one usually here in Ann Arbor, which is pretty close by, an hour and a half drive from Hillsdale. You know, being around other veterans and getting the right kind of care, and meeting my wife that I have now, who's so much more understanding than previously. Nobody really seemed to understand or even care. In fact, I just got an email from my wife back in 8th and I, the Marine Corps headquarters, you know, the silent drill team. And she sent me that and had a little note, you know, in honor of my husband. Mm. So she understands. And her father had been a Marine in World War II, and he came home and he was all messed up. She had a rough life with a father that had served on probably Guadalcanal and maybe Tarawa, Peleliu. You know, those were tough, tough battles. And I had known some people that had been part of the 7th Marines in Korea and the awful battles that they'd had. And hearing them describe it, I can understand what other Marines previous to us have went through. And I can understand what the young guys today have been through, too. And it's too bad that mankind hasn't found a way to get along.
Amen. And I'm thinking of a few different things right now. I know in your post-military career in journalism, you've had a chance to tell some of those stories of other veterans. And clearly you come to that with an understanding and an empathy that the rest of us wouldn't be able to manufacture the way you have from your experience. And I'd love to hear about some of that. But first, I've got to ask as well, given everything you shared, some of the things you saw, what you personally experienced, have you been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall? Have you had the experience of finding the names of guys that you knew and reflecting on that?
I've been there three times. Now, the first time, I had no idea, you know. I mean, I went, and all of a sudden, I was crying like a baby. And the next time I went, I said, well, I'm not going to do that. And then I cried like a baby. Now, the third time I went was my wife that I'm married to now. And I told her before I walked down to the wall, she says, you go by yourself. And I said, well, I'm not going to break up this time. And I cried like a baby. And the second time I went, I was standing there looking at some names on the wall, and I started talking to this guy that was standing next to me, and darned if we hadn't served together in Vietnam and we knew each other. And that was, we were crying together, which was kind of odd, you know. Just who knows what's going to happen in the future? And that was kind of a situation where, my gosh, how did this happen? I mean, just by chance. Most interesting. Yes, I've been there three times. We lost a good high school classmate in 1967. He died. Clifford Lynn Breeden, and his name is on the wall. A guy that I served with in Vietnam who was a really sharp young man, Lester Wiesium. And Lester was a talented writer and an outstanding young man. And he died trying to save another Marine's life. So both times I've you know, etched their names off the wall, and I have them in my... I have several volumes at home of photographs and stories and things that I kept over the years. But I've been there. And every time I go, I don't want to go back because I know what'll happen. You know, I'll feel it. Mm-hmm. Can't help but feel it, especially when there are other veterans around the area. And you see some guy with a Marine Corps hat on like I have on today, and the first words out of our mouth is, Semper Fi, brother. Semper Fi, do or die. Well, we did, but we didn't die. So God willing, we'll get over it someday. But thanks to God, and my wife and I go to the First Presbyterian Church here in Hillsdale. That's been a real godsend, if you will, in helping me understand things and helping me understand myself and life. And being associated with Hillsdale College has also done that. I worked here for 12 years in public affairs and 3 years in the athletic department, and I still do the webcasting for football and basketball. And being associated with, like, Dr. Larry Arn, And the people here at Hillsdale College is really been, and there's a lot of veterans on this campus now. All that together has been a real help to myself. I guess I feel a part. This is my home.
And you said something, you know, when you said you greeted a fellow Marine in Washington, D.C. at the memorial, and you said, Semper Fi, do or die, but we didn't die. And those 58,000 names are there because they died. And you mentioned why that number is really bigger when you add up the suicides and Agent Orange, which you've been affected by. How should we remember those names, those lives, that chapter of history, and what their sacrifice represents?
That's a really good question. How would we want to be remembered? As a Marine, I would want to be remembered as, I did my duty. I did the best that I could. Could I have done better? I don't know. I was young and inexperienced, but I did the best that I could, and I did my duty. As a man today, I think I would just want people to never forget. When they say, you know, war is hell, that's such an understatement. Mm. Yeah, war is more than hell. It is hell. When you're in the middle of combat, I mean... Your mind is controlled by your training, and you may be scared out of your wits, but you can't let that affect you, and you have to do your duty. And a lot of guys had a lot of problems with that. That was not easy to do. Somehow, of course, you know, the thing is, when we were kids and you wondered, would I be a coward? You know, could I do that? And, well, after training and everything, that very few people turn and run from the action. They do their duty. And so as a Marine, I'd like people to remember me as I did my duty. And as a man today, I'm a man of faith.
And you're still very active. You made reference to some of the things that you still do. You've been back here in your hometown for a long time. You've told a lot of stories about a lot of people. And you mentioned webcasting. So you're describing the athletic exploits of the Hillsdale Chargers on the gridiron and on the basketball court. Why do you do that? And how long are you going to keep it up?
Well, this Saturday, September 7th, 2024, I will begin my 24th year of doing Charger football with my partner, Jim Measel. And I plan to go one more year, 25. I want to be 25 years, and then I'm going to hang it up. I did radio broadcasting for high school sports, and I also had a program, historical program, called Tales of the Old Sauk Trail, US 12, that goes from Detroit to Chicago, is the Old Sauk Trail. A lot of history. That road's probably 1,000 years old. And so I had a series of on the air with our local radio station, WCSR, and that was a lot of fun. I did that for 5 years, and I did high school football, baseball, and basketball with my friend for 20 years, and I retired from that. And but I want to do this year and next year, and then I'll stop. The coaches that we have here at Hillsdale are really exceptional individuals. They're not... it's hard to describe. I mean, they are fantastic, hard-working people. And considering the academic requirements to attend Hillsdale College, you can't just go out and get 300-pound linemen, you know, from anywhere. They've got to have a 31 ACT and a 3.9 GPA. I mean, how many linemen or defensive backs are you going to find with that kind of academic success? And, you know, it's tough. And they work their tails off to make that happen. And we're still competitive. The basketball teams had a lot of success, the football team, volleyball teams, the track and field. And now, of course, we have shooting sports. A lot of colleges and universities don't do that, but we do at Hillsdale, and they've been very fortunate as well. I just admire the coaching staff, the entire athletic staff, the athletic director, John Tharp, who was the basketball coach and took the team to really fantastic. They made the Elite Eight a couple of years ago, which in Division II is tough to do because you're competing against schools that have no academic requirements, and they can take anybody. And to be able to, you know, have that sort of success is exceptional people. And to be associated with those kind of exceptional people, it puts a smile on my face and makes me feel good. Like, I've also had some success just being around them. For a while, I was the managing editor of the Hillsdale Daily News, which is a daily newspaper. And I've also been fortunate to write for some local publications. I think I mentioned to you that I had done a series of articles back in 1995 of the 50th year of the end of World War II, and I had interviewed a lot of veterans from World War II. That was an amazing experience to hear their stories and what they had gone through. So the Marine Corps gave me a career. I became a writer, something that in seventh grade I thought would be impossible. And to be honest, I'm not the world's greatest writer. I'm kind of an old hack, but I'm a damn good hack.
Well, and I've just got to ask, since you shared doing the series with World War II veterans, if that helped you, given everything you've already shared about your own experience in the Marine Corps and some of the challenges, did talking to those people and hearing their stories and what they endured help you process your own experience or give you a different perspective?
Oh, most definitely. We cried together. I cried with World War II veterans. And one of them, my gosh, he had a Distinguished Service Cross and two Silver Stars, three Bronze Stars, three Purple Hearts. Amazing. Absolutely. The things that they experienced was... some of it related to what we went through in Vietnam, but it was a different period and a different war. War is war, but there's still differences between what goes on and the kind of climate, topography, and whatnot. It has a lot to do with how you're fighting a war, what combat is involved in going through combat. It's a lot different in city fighting than it would be in the jungles or in desert fighting compared to what it would be in rice paddies. It's just a kind of a different deal.
Yeah, I know we're running short on time here, but I don't want to forget to say a couple things. One, thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for sharing a story with us that nobody else could share. You've told a lot of stories in your life, but I know you're not always telling your own story, and it helps us understand what you and so many others went through. And a lot of Vietnam veterans have shared with me that what they'd like to hear even more than thank you is welcome home. So welcome home, and clearly Hillsdale is your home.
Thank you, Paul. Much appreciated.
And if there's anything I didn't ask you that you feel is important to share, feel free.
I could go on for hours, actually. I mean, I've lived an eclectic life. I've had experiences that very few people have ever had. I was part of the team that held the world land speed record at the Bonneville Salt Flats. My partner, Gary Gablich, set it in 1970, 622 miles per hour in the Blue Flame. And we had a project for a new land speed record called the American Way. But unfortunately, Gary died on the street on his Harley Davidson after, you know, being a drag racer, a boat racer, and all kinds of racing experience. When I say eclectic, I have had so many different kinds of experiences and met so many different kinds of people that I could name drop all day long. And that's been living childhood dreams. One last story. When I started kindergarten here in 1950.
In this building?
Yes, in this building, my teacher, Anna Betts, says, well, what's your name? And I said, well, my name's Roy Rogers, but my mommy calls me Danny Beischer. Now, strange thing, she says, Roy, well, you come with me, Roy. Later on, when I was stationed at Barstow, we used to have the newspaper, the Barstow Prospector, printed every Thursday over at Apple Valley Inn, which was owned by Roy Rogers. And while they were getting the paper printed, I would go in and have breakfast. Well, one morning, Roy Rogers walks in. He and his wife had just got back from Vietnam, and he saw me sitting there in his uniform, and he came over and talked to me, and I had to tell him that story. And I said, you probably heard 100 of those. He says, oh, a couple thousand. And then I went to pay for my breakfast. He'd already paid for it.
Wow. Well, I've got one more question for you, because you've told us a lot of the things you've done, and obviously you're still going strong. Is there something on your list that you haven't done that you'd really like to do or experience or see?
Finish reading the Bible. I want to read it completely. I've been reading it a lot more than I ever did. And I think that's one thing I want to accomplish and be able to. I'll be 80 years old on my next birthday, which I know I might not look it, but I actually am 79 right now. And I would like to be able to live just long enough to make my 25th year doing Charger football and be able to see some of my grandchildren get a little older, and that would be great.
When you think back on almost 80 years and all the things we've talked about today and the things you didn't talk about, is there something you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Yeah, two things. Obviously, my service in the Marine Corps. Had I not been accepted to college, I probably would have stayed in the Marine Corps maybe for 20 years. I'm very proud of that. I did what I had to do. I did my duty, and it was a good thing. And the Marine Corps did so much for me, and I still have friends from my time in the Marines, and we're good friends. And the other thing is that I just hope that I could live long enough maybe to see the world not be so upside down.
Dan Beischer, Purple Heart veteran of the 3rd Marine Division in Vietnam. And the sports world will be right side up this weekend for Hillsdale College Charger fans when they once again hear his voice on the football broadcast for the 24th consecutive season. Find photos relating to the story Dan shared with us today at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're glad you spent this fascinating and eye-opening hour with us today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.